Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello again, this is Randall Rickman from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. This issue is dated October 29th, 2018. We go right to the back of the magazine to make sure that we include this week's interview feature. And this edition is called Nine Questions. Interview subject is Joseph J. Ellis. Time says Joseph J. Ellis is the best-selling historian on what the founders got wrong, restoring faith in government, and the case for national service. First question. American dialogue examines what George Washington, John Adams, James Madison, and Thomas Jefferson might think about issues dividing the country today. Why did you address the present in this book? Answer. I began work on this book 2 years before Donald Trump was elected president. But the forces that produced Trump, our deeply divided society, unsure of its future, and deeply distrustful of government, were already visible. Question. Do you feel like you have some answers now? Answer. Historians are really great at predicting the past, but the future is for prophets, and the track record of most prophets is dismal. Globalization, the internet, the sheer size of American society presents unprecedented problems. Until we recover some sense of the American dialogue, and we need to recover government as us rather than government as them, we're going to be paralyzed in this second gilded age. Question. Will the better angels of our nature save us? Answer. My view of history is that trusting in the better angels of our nature is a bad bet. The founders didn't believe in the better angels. They created a constitution which was designed to deal with imperfect human beings. Question. America has always had people who vehemently disagree. Are we that different now compared with in Jefferson's time? Answer. It's a size problem. There's a difference between 4 million people gathered on the Atlantic coast and 325 million people across the nation. The single most important difference is that we are attempting to do something that nobody has ever done before. Create a fully and genuinely multiracial society in a huge nation. Question. What is the biggest failing of the founders that still haunts us today? Answer. When the founders talked about, quote, we the people, unquote, they were not talking about black people. They weren't talking about women, and they weren't talking about Native Americans. Whenever race enters the question, the founders are going to end up disappointing you. Question. Can the constitutional system they created solve our problems? Answer. The founders would want us to recognize that it's a living constitution. So the originalists who want us to go back to the original meaning have it dead wrong. We have to make adaptations. The Electoral College has got to go. Question. In the early 1960s, nearly 80% of Americans said they trusted their government. By the mid-1970s, that number had dropped to around 20%, and it's never completely recovered. What happened? Answer. The Vietnam War, which undermined the credibility of the government for a whole generation of Americans. The second thing was the Civil Rights Movement. That alienated whites in the Confederacy. The third thing was Roe v. Wade. That alienates all the evangelicals. Question. What will finally unite Americans? Answer. A great crisis that leaves us no choice but to come together. When the coastal areas have to be evacuated, when the real implications of climate change begin to hit, we're going to be forced to come together. Final question. In their best moments, the founders put the public good ahead of the whims of public opinion. Is there any way to recover that sense of virtue? Final answer. I would favor mandatory national service. Now, of course, that has no chance. But every American woman and man should serve the public for 2 years. That doesn't mean military, but it means some form of service. Interview conducted for Time by Lucas Whitman. Interview subject, Joseph J. Ellis. The book referred to is American Dialogue, Joseph J. Ellis. Now we go to the front of the magazine where we pick up the first major section, which is the brief. And the subsection is opener, where the headline is, under education, with Harvard on trial, so is affirmative action. Article by Katie Riley. This article features an interview, a quotation rather, in red from Edward Bloom, conservative activist, and the quotation from Edward Bloom, quote, in a multiracial, multi-ethnic nation like ours, the admissions bar cannot be raised for some races, unquote. Katie Riley writes, long before it opened in U.S. District Court in Boston on October 15th, the trial over the use of race in Harvard University admissions had all the makings of a landmark case. In fact, the case stands to reconfigure the place of diversity in the American educational landscape. At its center is the oft-debated subject of affirmative action in college admissions. Those policies traditionally benefit African American and Latino students in an effort to offset centuries of racial discrimination. But the lawsuit alleges that Harvard's implementation of those ideas discriminates against Asian Americans. Harvard, which has defended its, quote, holistic, unquote, process, says the school strives for diversity as part of its educational mission, but denies that any of its practices are discriminatory. Quote, Harvard cannot achieve its educational goals without considering race, unquote, William Lee, an attorney for the university, said in court, according to news reports, adding that race is never considered negatively in applications. But attorneys representing Students for Fair Admissions, the group that brought the suit, will spend the next 3 weeks arguing that Harvard uses what amounts to a racial quota system, manipulating the process to, quote, achieve essentially the same racial balance year over year, unquote. Their suit, which has received support from the Trump administration, will focus on findings that Harvard assigns a lower, quote, personal rating, unquote, score to Asian American applicants as a group, who otherwise outperform other racial groups in academics and extracurriculars. Asian Americans, about 6% of the U.S. population, make up nearly 23% of Harvard's most recent class of admitted students, while African American students make up 15%, and Hispanic or Latino students make up 12%. Harvard first admitted a majority of non-white students 2 years ago. But while Harvard is, well, Harvard, it's still just one school. In his opening arguments, Adam Mortara, a lawyer representing the plaintiffs, took a narrow view of the case's implications. Quote, "This trial is about what Harvard has done and is doing to Asian American applicants, and how far Harvard has gone in its zeal to use race in the admissions process," unquote, Mortara said in court, adding that, quote, "The future of affirmative action in college admissions is not on trial," unquote. Experts see it differently. For decades, courts have tended to approve of careful affirmative action efforts. Harvard's approach won praise in the 1978 Supreme Court case, Regents of the University of California v. Bakke, which struck down a quota-based admissions policy at the University of California, but upheld affirmative action more broadly, pointing to the Cambridge, Massachusetts school as a good example because it considered race as a, quote, plus, unquote. But that case and others challenging the use of race in admissions have featured white students, a notable difference from the Boston suit. Meanwhile, a newly conservative Supreme Court increases the likelihood that previous rulings upholding affirmative action could be overturned if the case makes it to the highest court. Quote, "The current composition strongly suggests that affirmative action's days are numbered," unquote, says Justin Driver, a University of Chicago law professor whose new book, The Schoolhouse Gate, covers how courts have shaped education. Scholars aren't the only ones who think the case could have deep ramifications. The Students for Fair Admissions group was founded by Edward Bloom, a conservative activist who opposes all race-based admissions policies. Bloom has brought several other cases challenging affirmative action, including Fisher v. University of Texas, which resulted in a 2016 ruling that the university's race-conscious admissions program was legal. He has been explicit about his goal, to end affirmative action for everyone, everywhere. Quote, "Race and ethnicity should not be a factor when a student applies to a university like Harvard, or the University of North Carolina, or the University of Texas, or any university," unquote, Bloom said in prepared remarks at a Boston rally the day before the trial started. Quote, "In a multiracial, multi-ethnic nation like ours, the admissions bar cannot be raised for some races and lowered for others," unquote. Critics have accused Bloom of, quote, exploiting, unquote, Asian American students in pursuit of an agenda that could, by devaluing diversity, ultimately harm them, too. Surveys also show that a majority of Asian Americans support affirmative action policies, though support among Chinese Americans decreased to 38% this year, according to APIA Vote and AAPI data. Quote, "Race-conscious admissions is a limited tool, but it's still a tool needed to recruit and retain racially diverse student bodies," unquote, says Julie Park, an associate professor of education at the University of Maryland, who studies Asian American students and affirmative action. Park served as a consulting expert in the case on the side of Harvard. Quote, "I think if this case or another case leads to a nationwide ban on race-conscious admissions, everyone is going to lose out, including Asian Americans," unquote. but such a ban is just what Bloom wants. Quote, regardless of the outcome of this trial, unquote, Bloom said at the rally, quote, the movement to end racial classifications and preferences in college admissions will not end, unquote. Entire article by Katie Riley. Still in the brief, on the facing page, in the margin, we have the recurring feature called News Ticker. It's three news items stacked on top of each other in the right margin. Top item, Warren releases DNA test results. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, on October 15th, released the results of a DNA test showing she has a Native American ancestor, quote, 6 to 10 generations ago, unquote. President Trump has repeatedly mocked her claims of Native American heritage. She tweeted that the test was a response to his, quote, racism, unquote. Second item in the middle. China says its Muslim camps are, quote, humane, unquote. China broke its silence on October 16th on the indoctrination camps where an estimated 1 million minority Uyghur Muslims are being detained. China said the camps are a, quote, humane, unquote, part of a, quote, de-radicalization, unquote, and education program, contrary to their characterization by groups like Amnesty International. Bottom item, Washington ends capital punishment. Washington's Supreme Court struck down the state's death penalty on October 11th, citing evidence of racial bias in its use. Washington is the 20th U.S. state to abolish capital punishment, and the third to do so partly on the basis of evidence of racial disparities. Also on this page, the mini feature called The Bulletin, where the headline is, Pope Francis takes faltering steps forward on church abuse crisis. Article by Sierra Nugent. An unusually frank statement from the Vatican announced on October 13th that two retired Chilean bishops have been expelled from the priesthood for the, quote, manifest abuse of minors, unquote. Minors is spelled M-I-N-O-R-S. Coming only a day after Pope Francis accepted the resignation of U.S. Cardinal Donald Wuerl over mismanaging past abuse cases, the move suggested that church leaders are recognizing the seriousness of the sprawling child sex abuse scandal, though it remains unclear whether the Pope will take the zero-tolerance stance that victims and advocates demand. Blame game. That's the heading. Sierra Nugent mentions three general headings. Blame game, saving the church, and after the fall. Under the paragraph titled Blame Game, over 100 clergy are under investigation in Chile, which has proved a weak point for Francis, the first Latin American pope. In January, he caused an outcry by accusing victims of, quote, slander, unquote. Francis later apologized, saying he'd made, quote, grave errors, unquote, with that reaction. In May, after a Vatican report alleged a cover-up, all 34 active Chilean bishops offered their resignations. So far, the Pope has accepted 7. Second paragraph, saving the church. Soon after his papacy began in 2013, Francis set up a commission to, quote, protect minors, unquote. The church has since removed several high-profile figures accused of abuse, including Washington Archbishop Theodore McCarrick. But many were disappointed when Francis praised Wuerl's, quote, nobility, unquote, in resigning, and the commission has been criticized for toothlessness in pursuing those who ignored crimes. Final paragraph, after the fall. The abuse, which has also rocked Ireland, Spain, Germany, and Australia in recent years, has shaken trust in the Catholic Church and contributed to its global decline in influence. Parenthetically, the percentage of Catholics who attend Mass at least once a week has dropped in Europe from 37% in 1980 to 20% in 2012. In the Americas, it fell from 52% to 29%. Pope Francis has called for an extraordinary conference on the issue to be held in February. The strategy he settles on there could define his papacy and the future of the Church. Entire article by Sierra Nugent. Progressing further in the brief, we come to milestones. Lead item under died, Paul Allen, influential intellect. Observance by Bill Gates. Time notes, Gates is an entrepreneur and philanthropist and a co-founder of Microsoft. He is a co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Bill Gates writing about Paul Allen. Even when we were in high school, Paul Allen could see that computers would change the world. Paul, who died on October 15th at 65 of complications from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, was instrumental in creating and building Microsoft, which we launched together in 1975. But the interests and knowledge he loved to share with those around him reached far beyond computing. Paul loved sailing, science, sports, making music, and exploring the world. His generosity was as wide-ranging as his curiosity. He was passionate about ending elephant poaching, building smart cities, and accelerating brain research. His impact was felt most strongly in Seattle. Paul loved our hometown. He helped build homeless shelters and promoted arts education. He established one of the neatest museums I've seen, the Museum of Pop Culture, and helped make sure his beloved sports teams stayed in the Pacific Northwest by purchasing the NBA's Portland Trail Blazers and later the NFL's Seattle Seahawks. The world will remember Paul as a technologist and philanthropist whose passion touched millions of lives. But when I remember him, it will also be as a man who held his family and friends dear. I will miss him. Observance by Bill Gates, Paul Allen. This item is accompanied by a full-length color photograph. The caption says, Allen at his New York City home on October 15th, 2015. Paul Allen is standing in the photograph wearing a dark suit with a dark blue shirt and dark blue tie. Also under died, William Coors, a grandson of the founder of the Coors Brewery, at 102 on October 13th. A longtime leader of his family's company, he was an outspoken proponent of conservatism. Under begun, legal marijuana sales in Canada on October 17th. Canada became the second country where pot is legal nationally after Uruguay. Under arrived, Pastor Andrew Brunson on U.S. soil after 2 years imprisonment in Turkey on terrorism charges on October 13th. Brunson later met with President Trump. Under convened, a World Health Organization meeting on Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo on October 17th. The group decided not to designate the ongoing outbreak an emergency of global concern. Under changed, the name of the Indian city, Allahabad, to Prayagraj, which has Hindu associations rather than Muslim ones, by its state's Hindu nationalist leaders on October 16th. Was Allahabad, now Prayagraj. Under confirmed, 62 U.S. cases of a rare poliomyelitis, I'll correct that, confirmed, 62 U.S. cases of a rare polio-like illness called acute flaccid myelitis this year by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on October 16th. That polio-like illness is called again acute flaccid, spelled F-L-A-C-C-I-D, myelitis, spelled M-Y-E-L-I-T-I-S, acute flaccid myelitis. Under published, a study showing that climate change may make beer more expensive in the journal Nature Plants on October 15th. Under declared, bankruptcy for Sears, the store that shaped an era, observance by Olivia B. Waxman. When Richard W. Sears started a mail-order catalog business in 1888 with Alva C. Roebuck, it sold only watches and jewelry. More than 150 years later, their time has stopped, for now at least. On October 15th, Sears, once America's top retailer, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The catalog, which Time once called, quote, America's Family Album, unquote, launched during the golden age of railroads. That technology helped Sears provide customers with goods ranging from appliances to clothing, and at one point, 35 pounds of gumdrops for $1.65. As cities and chains grew, Sears again took advantage of the changes, opening its first store in Chicago in 1925. As the economy boomed after World War II, so did Sears, which had more than 700 locations by the mid-1950s. But nimble competition emerged. Sears started to lose market share to lower-cost retailers and failed to anticipate the 90s dot-com boom, and the attendant return to shopping by mail. Its last catalog was issued in 1993, and now analysts say it just can't compete with Amazon. The company that once sold practically everything may be left selling practically everything. This item is accompanied by a small black and white photograph of a Sears. It is boarded up. On the facing page, the recurring feature called Good Question, and the headline is, Why Did a Former Miss Iraq Flee Her Country? By Lainey Barron. It was the last Thursday in September when 22-year-old social media icon Tara Ferries was gunned down in Baghdad. It was a Thursday in August when a well-known beautician was found dead in her home. And the Thursday before that, when a plastic surgeon nicknamed Iraq's Barbie died in mysterious circumstances. Then, a former Miss Iraq, Shimon Kasim Abdul Rahman, was told she too would become one of the so-called Thursday victims. The terrified pageant queen, who won the title in 2015, says she has repeatedly received threats from ISIS members. But it was the brazen assassination of Fares and a chilling warning, quote, "You're next," unquote, that impelled Qasim into exile in Jordan to escape the fate of women, quote, "being slaughtered like chickens," unquote. Quote, "They killed many people in broad daylight. I couldn't wait to be killed and then say, oh, that was a serious threat," unquote, she told the Kurdish news site Rudaw on October 8th. Qasim joins a number of prominent Iraqi women, including Instagram star Isra al-Obaidi and activist Yanar Mohammed, who are seeking safety abroad. The series of deaths and threats of continued violence have not only sent shockwaves through Iraq, they've also sparked fears of a coordinated campaign against women who dare to speak out and defy gender norms. Quote, "The attackers on women were not singular incidents," unquote, Mohammed told German media from the airport moments before she fled Iraq. Quote, "The killings have been done against women who revealed their bodies, who revealed their faces, are outspoken on women's rights, women who did not submit to conventional Islamic ways," unquote. Hana Edwar, head of the Iraqi Women Network, tells Time that even if the killings were not carried out by the same group, quote, "They are linked in their extremist approach and in their thinking that they don't want women in the public sphere," unquote. Iraqi women once enjoyed some of the most progressive laws in the Arab region, but since 2003, activists have noted a deterioration of women's rights. After the U.S.-led coalition toppled Saddam Hussein's regime, extremist militias flourished. As Iraq this month establishes its new cabinet, nearly 5 months after national elections, Edwar says the militias want to emphasize that, quote, "safety and security is in their hands and not the government's," unquote. Outgoing Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has blamed the, quote, "well-planned kidnappings and killings," unquote, on unspecified, organized groups trying to destabilize the government, though no group has claimed responsibility. Edwar agrees that some factions benefit from instability, but says those responsible have another goal, too, one that's been tragically steady. Quote, "They want to send the message," unquote, she says, quote, "that women should stay away from political life," unquote. Entire article by Lainey Barron. On this page, in the left margin, is another edition of the sidebar feature News Ticker. Again, three news items stacked in the margin. Top item: Yemen faces worst famine in 100 years. Up to 13 million civilians in Yemen could be at risk of starvation in the next 3 months if the war there is not halted, according to the UN. A famine of that scale would be the world's worst in 100 years. The war, supported by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, has claimed tens of thousands of lives since it began in 2015. Middle item: hackers attack North Carolina water utility. Hackers perpetrated a ransomware attack on the Onslow Water and Sewer Authority in Jacksonville, North Carolina, the utility revealed October 15th, 11 days after it began experiencing problems. Officials said the water supply was not in danger. The area is still recovering from Hurricane Florence. Final item: Do your chores, Assange told. The government of Ecuador has ordered WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who has been holed up in its London embassy since 2012, to clean the bathroom and take better care of his cat. He must also avoid talking about political issues if he wants to keep his internet privileges, which were recently restored after months of restrictions. Moving ahead, and we are now in the major section called The View, and we come to a regular feature in the margin, a sidebar called Short Reads. Time explains highlights from stories on time.com/ideas. And again, it's three items at time.com/ideas. Top item, more Brexit dangers. The possibility of creating a hard border between Ireland and Northern Ireland concerns George J. Mitchell, a former U.S. Senate Majority Leader who chaired the nation's peace talks. Among other problems, he writes, it could undo, quote, the intangible but important consequence of a steep reduction in negative stereotyping and demonization, unquote. Central item, the pains of typecasting. Zico Zaki, the lead actor of CBS's FBI, wrote an essay describing his joy as a Muslim American to finally play a hero who practices Islam and how Hollywood could create more such roles. As series progress, writers adapt to their actors, unquote, he writes, quote, but this should and can start from the beginning, unquote. Final item, an Internet Bill of Rights. A U.S. Representative, Ro Khanna, described the 10 principles he helped devise for future laws that seek to protect our increasingly digital lives. Quote, there should be an understanding and trust that your privacy and data will be protected, unquote, he writes. Still in the view, this subsection is called Ideas, and here is a recurring feature in Ideas called the Risk Report. The headline is Japan's Tricky Balancing Act Between the U.S. and China by Ian Bremmer. Despite what you may have heard from a certain U.S. president, trade wars are both difficult and hard to win. Even more difficult, being invested in the outcome of a trade war with limited ability to affect it. Case in point, Japan, which is eyeing the unfolding trade drama between China and the U.S. with increasing concern. According to the Pew Research Center, just 24% of the Japanese population has confidence in U.S. President Donald Trump. Their confidence in Chinese President Xi Jinping barely cracks double digits at 11%. But even if Japan had more faith in the principal players involved, Tokyo would have every right to be on edge. Should relations between China and the U.S. take a dramatic turn for the worse, Japan is on the sharp end of the spear. Economically, the two countries represent by far Japan's largest export markets at around 20% each. Geopolitically speaking, its proximity to China and its dependence on a U.S., whose president shows a lack of commitment to long-standing allies and treaty obligations, make it vulnerable. Japan understands this and did so long before the rest of the world caught on. It's the reason Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe jumped on the first flight to New York City following Trump's election night victory. Even before Trump took the oath of office, Abe understood that for him, alliances are built on personal relationships and transactional exchanges, not historical ties. So far, Abe has done as much as one can reasonably expect a Japanese leader to do to accommodate that reality. He has met with Trump more than any other world leader. When Abe visited Mar-a-Lago last spring, Trump vowed to support Japan because Abe was his, quote, good friend, unquote. Japan has joined the U.S. and the European Union in co-sponsoring a proposal to reform the World Trade Organization to strengthen enforcement against countries that subsidize certain industries, an obvious swipe at China. And unlike the EU, Japan has taken a much more muted approach to Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs, pushing back against them quietly, while at the same time signaling to the U.S. administration its willingness to enter into formal bilateral trade negotiations, which has long been a priority for Trump. But Abe also understands that the current U.S. president is nothing if not mercurial, which means he needs to hedge. It's no coincidence that Japan just announced that Abe will be traveling to China on October 25th, his first official visit in 7 years, complete with a trade delegation of 579 companies and numerous business leaders in tow. There has even been talk about the possibility of Japan's joining China's Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, parenthetically AIIB, which is Beijing's answer to the Washington-based International Monetary Fund, parenthetically IMF, and World Bank. Under Barack Obama, the U.S. declined to join the Development Bank, even as European allies like France, Germany, and the U.K. decided to sign up. Back then, Japan stood fast with the U.S. Now, times have changed, and political calculations along with them. Of course, the reality of Japan's precarious situation is that this hedging strategy works only so long as U.S.-China relations don't completely go off the rails. Should that happen, Japan would have little choice but to side with its close ally, the U.S., but from a position of weakness rather than one of strength. And if you don't think that matters to someone like Trump, you haven't been paying attention. Watch this space. Japan certainly will be. Article by Ian Bremmer. Sharing this page in the right margin, under technology, the headline is An Anti-Phone Phone's Real Message by Alex Fitzpatrick. The Palm, a $349.99 mini smartphone, announced on October 15th by the makers of the Palm Pilot, is meant to serve as a sidekick, a shrunken separate phone on your existing wireless plan that Palm suggests you take when on the move, parenthetically, especially to escape your main phone's superpowers. Instead, it reveals sad truths about smartphones today. Since there was so much information in that sentence without help from time, we'll repeat that phrase with better emphasis. The Palm, a $349.99 mini smartphone, announced on October 15th by the makers of the Palm Pilot, is meant to serve as a sidekick. Catching up with the article, companies are abandoning small phones in favor of bigger devices that don't fit everyone's hands. Even the smallest new iPhone is nearly 2 inches bigger than Apple's previously smallest offering. Parenthetically, Google's just announced Pixel phones are also large. The Palm is hardly a solution. Nobody should have to pay additional hundreds of dollars plus monthly fees for a comfortable device. Meanwhile, Palm claims the device can help people get, quote, into their lives, unquote. A, quote, life mode, unquote, disables alerts until users check the handset. While small phones may be less consuming than big ones, anyone claiming the solution to tech overload is more tech shouldn't be trusted. The answer lies not in new gadgets, but in better mastery of and willingness to ignore those we already own. Entire item by Alex Fitzpatrick. Moving ahead, this article is entitled The Middle Road. The Democrats' Path Back to Power Runs Through the Heartland by Philip Elliott, Dateline, Ross, Ohio. Sheree Bustos shows her opponents no mercy, even in skee-ball. The hyper-competitive three-term congresswoman from Northwest Illinois is walking with a fellow Democrat at a union picnic in the Cincinnati area when she spots the arcade game. Quote, Aftab, unquote, she calls to Aftab Puraval, a former prosecutor who was looking to unseat an 11-term Republican in this southwest corner of Ohio. Quote, how are you at skee-ball, unquote. Soon, both are shoving tokens into the machine. But as the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee's chair of Heartland Engagement, Bustos is a professional multitasker. Between turns, she talks about the bigger competition she's focused on now, helping House Democrats win a block of seats that stretches from Omaha to the Philadelphia suburbs. Democrats have struggled in these working-class districts in recent years, but Bustos has ideas for how to win them back. First, don't lead with the controversial issues that are popular with the party's fringe. High-cost, pie-in-the-sky proposals for a guaranteed universal wage and single-payer health care can be toxic with voters who think government is already doing too much and little of it well. Quote, you don't go into a room starting there, unquote, Bustos says. She knows whereof she speaks. Bustos won her 2016 re-election race by 20 percentage points in a district President Donald Trump narrowly carried. And she's quick to point out that while primary victories by far-left candidates may have captured headlines, the best pickup chances this election cycle comes because moderate candidates are poised to lure Republican and moderate voters to pull the lever for Democrats. Now, as the de facto leader of a 12-state Democratic campaign, Bustos is looking to unleash the fierce urgency of centrism across America's heartland. That's one reason she's become a campaign mentor to several of the Democratic Party's top House recruits. In Michigan, former CIA officer and Pentagon official Elissa Slotkin is within striking distance of unseating a Republican in her Lansing district. Iowa State Representative Abby Finkenauer, 29, recently snagged the influential Des Moines Register's endorsement, and polls suggest she's favored to become the youngest woman ever elected to Congress. Amy McGrath, the first woman to pilot an F-A-18 on a Marine combat mission, is running strong in a conservative Kentucky district. Others, like Teresa Gasper in Dayton, Ohio, face tougher prospects, which is why Bustos spent part of an August Sunday in the district trying to help Gasper attract voters by talking up meat and potatoes issues like infrastructure and military spending at nearby Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Bustos' efforts may prove pivotal in November. Democrats could net the 23 seats they need for a majority just through the states under Bustos' purview. More important, victory is impossible without them. That means control of the House of Representatives, and all that comes with it, may hang on the pitch that the 57-year-old former newspaper reporter is delivering across the region to voters and Democratic candidates alike. America's heartland wasn't always painted red. There was a time when Democrats could win House races in places like Evansville, Indiana, Waterloo, Iowa, and Janesville, Wisconsin. Yet, it's gotten tougher to carry such places with a D after your name. The number of moderates in the House Democratic Caucus has dwindled in recent years. The coalition of conservative Democrats in the House now numbers just 18. Being a Democrat in a red district requires a feel for cultural issues and a willingness to defy party orthodoxy. Quote, when I was going into union halls when Hillary Clinton was running, the first question was, is Hillary going to take our guns, unquote, Bustos says, as she walks through the union picnic. Bustos knows how to dispatch that question. Quote, I have three sons. They all hunt, unquote. If that doesn't do it, she mentions that her husband is a captain with a local sheriff's department. Because Bustos walks Purval, the Democratic candidate, running in a district that has been represented for 11 of the past 12 terms by Republican Steve Chabot, or Chabot, Purval, a 36-year-old first-generation American, has worked to prosecute federal crimes against children and represented local behemoth Procter & Gamble. In 2016, he became the first Democrat to win the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts job in a century. The district is gerrymandered to the GOP's advantage, but Purval has been outraising Chabot and nipping at the incumbent's heels. Listen to Purval chat with voters, and it's clear that he's a different kind of Democrat. Asked about Trump, he says he agrees with the president on the need for infrastructure investment. Asked about the anti-Trump resistance movement, he says some people are more interested in screaming than listening, and that's not of interest to him. Asked about the odds of a Democrat's prevailing here, he notes Barack Obama twice won Hamilton County. Quote, we can't expect change if we keep sending the same person and same leadership to Washington, D.C. year after year, unquote, he tells union members who have rented out the amusement park on this Saturday in August. For candidates like Purval to run this way in 2018 cuts against headlines. Progressive candidates are capturing the imagination of the party's motivated activists, especially the younger cohort. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for instance, unseated House Democratic Caucus Chair Joseph Crowley in June in New York City, triggering media coverage that suggested Ocasio-Cortez embodied the Democrats' future. The focus on the party's left-wing insurgents worries moderates who know Republicans will use the positions of one candidate to caricature the rest. Quote, that is not where the party is heading, unquote, Bustos says, of the socialist positions favored by Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Bernie Sanders. Quote, that fit for Queens, okay, unquote. Instead, she wants candidates talking about creating jobs through infrastructure, keeping health care costs low, and stamping out corruption, three unmet Trump promises. Some of her peers feel the same way about the emerging push to abolish immigration and customs enforcement in the wake of the Trump administration's family separation policy. Quote, I understand the emotions, the moral vacuum that is involved in splitting up families, unquote, says Jim Himes, a Connecticut Democrat and the chairman of the House's 68-member moderate New Democrat Coalition. Quote, but when you go out there and say, this is who we are, you've now made life harder for those 60 or 70 Democrats fighting in districts where we need to win if we ever want to be in the majority, unquote. To reorient the party, centrist groups like Third Way have been pushing candidates to read up on history and polling. Quote, the party is not going to go in the direction of Sanders-style socialism because it's not winning on the issues and it doesn't win politically except in a very, very limited number of places, unquote, Third Way President Jonathan Cowan tells Time. Quote, it's going to go in the direction that won it two presidencies. The last two-term Democratic presidents were mainstream Democrats. That's what's going to get the House back, unquote. We've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen next time. I'm Randall Rickman, reading for Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. That's TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. I'm Randall Rickman, thanking you again for joining me and for your patience in staying with me through our issue of Time Magazine. Please join us next time for Time Magazine.